want to break into the system.
Someone without access to the exam.
I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the December 12th edition of the In and Out Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with
VR
in the house. All right, well, we're going to go straight into the news. We got a lot of interesting things to talk about, as usual. And, of course, always post any stories that you find interesting out there, news, comments on our forums on slipnet.org. And here we go. All right, well, we've talked about a lot of the technologies that, Google's talking about coming out with and rumored to have happened. And
speculation up the wazoo.
Yeah, and their IPO and all that good stuff. Well, Google's going to be doing something new with television.
Is it going to be Smell-O-Vision?
No.
Or Goo-O-Vision, that it's actually going to come out and, like, goo ya,
no. It's kind of like the movie Hackers. There's one scene in the movie Hackers where the main guy, the story, the head honcho, he's breaking into the system. And he's breaking into, like, the local cable company or something like that. And he changes the movies every night that he wants to watch to. Like, watch on the system.
Uh-huh.
So it shows this, you know, mechanical auto tape loader loading these tapes and stuff like that. And, of course, Angela Jolie in the movie... is like, hey, what the heck? Somebody changed my program, because she does the same thing. And so there's this hacking war thing going on to try to shut, you know, him out, and she ends up shutting him out and says, like, you know, mess with the best, I like the rest, or whatever. And he's what, Zero Cool, and she's Acid Burn.
Yes.
And so that whole thing. Well, basically, get back to the point here. Google's trying to do something like that to where you can search out shows whenever you want and put it on.
Right on.
So there's a few companies out there that are trying to do a few things. I'll just go straight in the article here. Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo are quietly developing new search tools for digital video, foreshadowing a high-stakes technology arms race in the battle for control of consumers' living rooms. We talked about, like, the new Xbox might be this big media center, stuff like that, and you can see where Microsoft's aiming with that, and of course they have that one PC TV program of theirs, I forget what it's called. Google's effort, until now, secret, is arguably the most ambitious of the three. According to sources familiar with the plan, the search giant is courting broadcasters and cable networks with a new technology that would do for television what it has already done for the Internet. Sort through and reveal needles of video clips from within the Haystack archives of major network TV shows. The effort comes on top of Google's plans to create a multimedia search engine for internet-only video that will likely be introduced next year. In recent weeks, Mountain View, California-based Google has demonstrated the new technology to a handful of major TV broadcasters in an attempt to forge alliances and develop business models for a TV searchable database on the web. Google.
That's beautiful, because I've always, you know, like, I always, you know, I really want to see, like, some first, you know, the first series of some shows now, and you know, like, can't do it until they come out on, like, DVD or VHS later on, like, 5 years down the road.
Yeah, well, you know, the great thing about the internet that we all know is that it's information at your fingertips, so now, why not get, you know, videos and movies and stuff like that at your fingertips and get that streamed over to you? So that, I mean, that's really going to be an interesting thing, and I think it's going to be very big. Microsoft, basically, it has its sights on interactive TV market for cable providers, being ushered in by convergence devices such as Microsoft's Media Center PC software. is building technology that will let people with a Media Center PC or internet connected television comb through and find specific video files available over the internet broadcast and video on demand networks, according to a source. So I don't think theirs doesn't seem to be as large as Google's plan. Google seems to be doing the all out, get everything at your fingertips type thing, moving things over the network. Microsoft seems to be handling niche stuff, but you know, I'm sure they're going to try to open themselves up to do what Google's doing. But
what they're probably do is once Google kind of gets everybody worked together, that's when they'll take over, because they'll make Google take all the major startup costs.
Yeah, and copy their development.
Yeah, and then they'll just take over.
So, I don't know. We'll see what happens, but you know, it's good for the consumers, I believe. Hopefully, you know, depending on what could be and what the corporations will make it be. So, we'll report on that as things go on in the future. Now, this article here is pretty interesting. It's more about some of the automation that the Army's doing. Start thinking about Terminator and all this crazy stuff. And actually, there's a company in here called iRobot, which is pretty funny.
Wait, iRobot has actually been pretty... the company's been pretty prolific lately with their products.
Yeah. Basically, the Army next March will begin to deploy Talon robots from Waltham, Massachusetts-based company Foster Miller. The robots will be mounted with a M2040 or M240 or an M249 machine guns, and the units can also be mounted with a rocket launcher. Defense agencies have been testing an armed version of the Talon since 2003. Putting guns on robotic vehicles is a natural evolution of the technology, which is being adopted to decrease risks to personnel in the field. Several robots, including the Talon and the PackBot and iRobot, have been used to conduct surveillance missions such as taking pictures inside the caves of Tora Bora of Afghanistan during the conflict. And other robots have been mounted with disruptors, guns that disable bombs and mines. The robot coming next year from John Deere and iRobot will ferry supplies and from the front, navigating its travel with little human input. A robot vehicle with a machine gun will essentially enable soldiers to stay in a safe area while attacking the enemy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, sounds good. And then you got to think, though, which it's already been pondered, especially in the movie Terminator, what happens, you know, when automation becomes so powerful, and you know, the Matrix and all that stuff.
That's quite a ways off.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's
right now, it's a great thing because wow, you can have this thing that gets shot up and you can replace it or you scrap it. When a human being's not that quite easy to do that.
Yeah.
Now I'm kind of curious on what is it Talon a ground based robot or an air based robot?
It's ground based.
So okay, so
it's got wheels on it like a tank, you know, and it's mini and it walks. It drives like that.
So like Johnny Five really was the appropriate image to have in my mind.
There's a picture of it right there.
Yeah, actually, it's very similar.
It's Johnny Five with a machine gun.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yep. So, and the rocket launcher version right there.
The Talon is alive.
Yeah. Johnny Five is alive.
I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah. Johnny Five didn't have a Mac 10.
Yeah, but he did have a laser gun.
He did.
Yes, he did.
That's true. You know, pretty soon they'll take that technology and modify it, and you'll have yourself a robot in your kitchen like the Jetsons.
Well, the iRobot actually has a little vacuum robot now that
yeah.
you can get for like $300 or something like that.
It's like two payments of $19.95.
I thought it was more than that.
Yeah, they have a cheap one. It's on the internet. On television at night. You know, I just don't know what getting off the subject here, but that thing is so small. You know, I'm like, where's the real sucking power? It's kind of like those
It would be like what's called a butler. It's this little thing that rolls back. You push back and forth.
Yeah,
it's got a little roller brush in it.
Yeah,
that's pretty much all it is. But what I want is one of those that cuts the lawn.
And yeah, those are pretty cool.
They can just put it out in the lawn, especially for like $40. They have it cut all the grass all the time. It'd be great.
I want to see it like run over a little kid.
Yeah.
crashes, gets an internal blue screen of death, and it goes wild.
Cuts everybody else's line but yours.
Yeah. That would be funny. Actually, that somebody walks over and, like, after it's done, it's resting, and you're like, you know, it sneaks up, the guy sneaks over there and puts it in his lawn and sends it off. So I wouldn't mind, as long as he filled it up with gas. All right. Well, this is a new social habit, I guess you could say, on the internet. Well, it's not totally new, but it's being more recognized that, and this article specifically talks about Korea, but most of the time, people nowadays, at least in my experience, use things like Messenger and text messaging more than email. And basically, this article is just kind of talking about, like, does this new area or all this new, these new forms of online communication, does that spell the end of, you know, email? You know, I don't ever believe there'll be an end to email. It's kind of like sending, like, legitimate docs back and forth. But if you need, like, a short response or you're saying hi.
Yeah, but it's going to be more like become the U.S. mail.
Yeah.
Where it's going to be, like, for documentation and, like, real memos and that sort of thing. But human, the like instant messenger and text messaging, is a much more human based communication format.
Yeah, and it's direct interaction.
Yeah.
You know what I want to figure out is why is it that we have these cell phones, and people insist on sending you a text message on the thing that has a crappy keyboard. You know, it and you send text messages back and forth, and I don't know why people just don't call.
You know, whenever I try to do it, it always takes me longer than if we're just call them and tell them.
Seriously, people send a message like, hey, you know, slip what's up. And I just get on the phone and call them right back. I'm like, hey, yeah, what's going on?
So, like, oh, really? I was talking to somebody else, but I wanted to text you. Well, too bad.
Yeah. The email era is coming to an end because replacement communication means such as internet messengers, many home pages dubbed one-man media, and SMS are wielding their power. The perception that email is an old and formal communication means is rapidly spreading among them, talking about Koreans. I use email when I send messages to elders, said a college student, and I use only for receiving cell phone and credit card invoices. So, you know, legitimate docs, the messaging, the conversation is saying that it's being done more through instant messaging. A poll conducted by Chinchbok University computer education professor Lee Okwa on over 2,000 middle and high school and college students in Gyeonggi and Chungji-cheong. Doing my best here.
Yeah, doing it good. And I would have just said an unpronounceable Asian name.
Yeah, to me at least. Provinces in October revealed that more than two-thirds of the respondents said, I rarely use or don't use email at all. Reasons given for shunning email are the impossibility to tell whether an addressee has received a message right away or replies are not immediately forthcoming. Still another reason is that you send messages through SMS or Messenger as if you were playing a game, while doing that so through email make you feel as if you're doing homework or performing a task. The new generation hate agonizing and waiting to tend to express their feelings immediately. The decline
impulsive of and impatient.
It's called adult ADD. The new term. Adult ADD. If you're suffering from adult ADD.
Just, yeah, no patience.
Yeah. The decline of email is a natural outcome reflecting such characteristics of the new generation. You know what's funny is when there's a lot of times where I'll send somebody a message and I'm like, hi. And this is my back to like, hi. You know, I'm like, and then I proceed with my conversation. I'm like, oh, you know, how's things? And, you know, you wait for like 5 minutes. And then say, oh, it's great. You know, and I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to be doing this or whatever. And then you wait again. And a lot of people are like that. I mean, there's a lot of patience involved in doing instant messaging sometimes because people were just like, hi. And I'm like, oh, I'll just go do a task and I can come back and, you know, read this thing later or whatever. And I've seen
that's kind of what I do with you whenever you text message me.
Yeah,
I'm usually doing something else. So.
Yeah, and I do that with others. Sometimes I used to be like adamant, like always there, and now I'm like, no, screw this. Like, you know, people don't always, they're not replying back and forth to me, so I'm just like, all right, you know, and shoot it off and go. Unless you'd like have an interaction like back and forth. Yeah. So it's I can see it being more popular, and you know, it's also interesting doing the text messaging through the cell phones. That And there are times I do find that I don't want to call them and say hi. You know, I just want to, like, just say, hey, what's up? And then see what they say or something like that. It's like these short, concise messages. Like, you kind of get rid of the BS. And I guess I answered my question that I asked earlier, why people do that. But you do. You get kind of rid of the BS because you don't want to type extra lines you don't have to type.
Yeah.
You know, and you want to form your conversation right away and just be direct.
But see, that's actually, like, you know, detrimental to, like, communication and intimacy and relationship building.
Oh, do you think, like, there's intimacy nowadays? I mean, there's no intimacy.
Well, yeah, especially with email and, you know, text messaging and all that. Like, the good old days of actually, like, the art and, you know, and craft of conversation is virtually dead.
Well, I don't think it's dead when you're doing a lot of, like, socializing. But, you know, face-to-face, it's getting... It depends, I guess. I guess it depends on the crowd. But, yeah, it is a lot of that, you know, is weaning out with this technology. Is definitely...
Well, most socialization conversation is, do you party?
Yeah, do you party?
Then what do?
Do you shoot porn? I do. No, sure. But, yeah. That's true. I don't know. Maybe it's just Arizona. Maybe just the state sucks.
No.
Which I've come to...
No, actually, it's a pretty liberal state, so...
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. From what I've heard in other parts of the country, it's pretty good out here.
All right. All right. Well, that's it for that. You know, moving on here, and this is something I felt more and more and more as time goes by. I feel like with my... Well, here's the article. Here's the news. Half of U.S. IT operations jobs to vanish. Now, I don't totally believe half, but I feel, and this is my word that I use, is that I feel that IT guys or system administrators, people that do low-level tasks, like system administrator used to be God, you know, whoa, system administrator. But now it's like more of a low-level task, like, oh, you can do that, but can you secure this? And can you do that? And can you do VPN or remote? Can I? You know, I guess that's all system administrator stuff.
It's more like evolution.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of those tasks that were more important before, more like, you know, I call them the network janitor guys. And they just go in and mop the network up when it's got some dirty, you know, some dirt, and they put a little sign up saying working here, you know, and then they leave. But that's all to do with evolution to technology, like software and servers becoming more automated and easier to use and stuff like that. Doesn't mean it's necessarily better. Easy to use sometimes means you get cut out of a lot of the features that you could be tweaking yourself if you wanted to, you know, be more precise, and that leaves room for other things like security problems. And I think the security people are the ones that are going to be the new, well, they are the new people that are taking care of business out there in the tech world of...
But still, there's going to be fewer of them than there were system administrators.
Oh yeah, yeah, they're going to definitely be fewer.
And so, you know, and as it keeps evolving, there's going to be fewer and fewer IT people, because even, you know, like, it can essentially get down to, you know, 50 to 120 years or so of down to, like, one programmer that takes care of most of the world's programming issues.
Yeah, the better that software becomes, and hardware and all that stuff, the less you're going to have to troubleshoot it. And, you know, mainly if you have, like, extra IT guys, they call them help desk guys, you know, they're there to do the customer service portion of the whole IT world. And it's getting a lot better to where people can manage multiple services, processes, you know, computers, whatever, all at once, on their own. So.
Yeah, if you think Microsoft's a monopoly now, wait until, you know, gets down to like one or two programmers for the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be some battles there.
I don't know. I think there's always going to be hobbyists out there.
Well, yeah, there's, but, you know, like, professionally, there'll only be a handful.
Basically, researchers over at Gartner Inc., basically they said that they believe that as many as 50% of the IT operational jobs in the U.S. could disappear over the next two decades.
I propose it'd be faster than that.
Yes, and, you know, they said that with increases in the automation of manufacturing and a few other things, it's going to help dwindle. Let's see. Basically, okay, they said companies that improve automation in IT operations become more like a factory, and that's what companies are constantly doing. and it's making the IT architecture a lot less less need to be managing it. So that's, you know, a lot of people went out and like, I'm going to get my MCSE and I'm going to make 50 grand or more and do this whole Microsoft thing. You know, it's, those people are coming a dime a dozen now, MCSE people. And
yeah, well, it's just evolutions that, you know, that that niche is decreasing. And so they're going to have to either evolve or die.
Pretty much. And we'll come up with a new new hobby.
Yeah, there will be.
New tech hobby after that.
And then it'd be like, you know, I don't know, something with video games. That's going to be the big new industry.
That's already a pretty big industry. I actually think video games are dwindling out. I think everything is becoming more of just a fun distraction. Be it the big Google search engine, you know, movie store, you got this video game you can pop in, and, you know, cell phones and computers and internet and conversations, and it's...
Which is all just a different form of drug.
Oh, yeah. It's it really just is. Something to keep you busy and keep you excited and, you
distract you from your empty, alienated state.
Yeah. And it's good because, well, it's got a wide range for most people. Most people can participate in all these activities and not need another individual to do it, or not necessarily need popularity or approval to do it. They can just do it.
They can be like, I don't need anybody because I don't know how to socially interact anymore. It just more and more it gets back to the Bad Religion song of, I'm a 20th century video boy. I don't have a lot of friends, but I have a lot of toys.
Yeah, it reminds me of this one song, actually. It's kind of talking about pinball.
Oh, that's Tommy.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, classic.
All right. You know, speaking of game piracy, our next bit of news basically talks about U.S. officials raid stores and arrest two in game piracy. Federal authorities raided three Washington, D.C. area video game stores and arrested two people for modifying video game consoles to play pirated video games, and video game industry a video game industry group said on Wednesday, which is back in early December there. Authorities arrested two store employees of charge of conspiracy to commit copyright infringement and conspiracy to traffic in a device that circumvents technology protection measures. What they're talking about is a modded Xbox, basically, and there's even modded PlayStations. Like other entertainment industries, video game business has aggressively pursued the pirates that it says account for billions of dollars in lost revenue annually. The piracy problem alerts from illegal activity and illegal copying of game discs. You know, it's just something that's going to keep happening no matter what they do. They're going to bust people, but there's ways of doing it to where it's pretty hard to even find out that you have those games and stuff like that. Now, if you're at a store and you're selling certain things that obviously can be proven to be illegal or cause you some sort of...
Yeah, we're calling them the Super Box.
Yeah, the Super Box. Well, the Super Box basically is a modded Xbox and allows you to play video games. Games from different emulators and all sorts of stuff. MP3s, movies, everything. So, I mean,
see, what a great thing. Why crush that incredible product? Just embrace it. Endorse it. It's all good.
You know, one of the problems I have with them counting up how much money that they lose in revenues, it's kind of like, well, if you got this for free, sure, I'll take it. But what if nothing was for free and they had to pay for it? And they're like, well, yeah, I got to pay for any of those games. I'm not in the mood.
Yeah, see, like, if I were to get one of those for free, I'd use it. But I'm not going to pay for anything.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's why I don't have any, you know, video game equipment anymore.
So, now going after the video game piracy industry. Now, they did that before. I mean, they went after, you know, sites that sold mod chips and things like that. And I can see that as, you know, moving on to this, and they've finally done it. So, it's, you know, it's an evolution. It's, things are not going to stop. It's going to continue, and it still continues. And they'll continue to try to protect what they can.
Yeah, see, that's the great thing about being liberal, is liberalism is all about embracing change and striving, you know, and looking for new opportunities. While conservatism is always wanting to go back to the past and keep things the same.
Yeah.
So business is all about being liberal. So it's really kind of funny for me to think about, like, Republicans being conservative. That doesn't seem to work. But anyway, that's my little political thought there.
All right. That's what we have the show for.
So I can get out my little zines of thought.
Yes. And I feel like we're moving so fast, but we have a lot of other things to bring up. Unprotected PCs can be hijacked in minutes. Now, this is something I've talked about in a previous show where I had a story where I plugged in, I reinstalled a Windows 2000 machine. It had, I think, Service Pack 1 on it by default, and it was on the internet, and I'm going to grab patches. But before I could get all the patches on, the machine was already infected. And this...
That's really bad.
Yeah, this was saying, and it was under 5 minutes. It was under 5 minutes, and actually this article, I believe, it said that happened to their computers in under 4 minutes. Simply connecting to the internet and doing nothing else exposes your PC to nonstop automated break-in attempts by intruders looking to take control of your machine surreptitiously. They put a few boxes out there on the net for an hour. Here's some of the stats. Each PC was connected to the internet via a broadband DSL connection and monitored for 2 weeks in September. Break-in attempts immediately began and continued at a constant high level, an average of 341 per hour against the Windows XP machine with no firewall or recent security patches, and 339 per hour against the Apple machine, and 61 per hour against the Windows Small Business Server. And it just took them out. And when talking about security, a lot of people say, don't even plug it in until you have everything set up and patched. And the funny thing is, too, is that people can, mess with the patches that are out there, and people can get a hold of them, and, there's just all sorts of stuff that goes on with the... your PC, and you don't know if you're downloading those patches from an untrusted source.
Yeah.
And you could install that, and something could happen.
Yeah, the patches themselves could be infected.
Yeah. In here it says an estimated 67% of consumers do not use a firewall, according to the National Cyber Security Alliance. So 67%, that's not bad, having 23%, actually. Is it 23? It's 33%. Yeah, 33. That's actually not too bad. At 33% of things are firewalled out there. I'm actually surprised that it's that big of a figure. But nowadays, things like Norton Antivirus and Trend Microsystems, Panda Antivirus, Zone Alarm, Windows XP Service Pack 2 are integrating more things like home firewalls and with their antivirus stuff, and spyware blocker and pop-up blocker and all that good stuff. So it's getting better out there, not as far as the viruses hitting the things, but the machines, I think, are slowly getting better to a better standard of security. Getting away from that. It's actually not getting away from the running all sorts of services model and then worrying about things later, because people are still running all sorts of services that these firewalls are just more designed to block all those things ahead of time and then ask you yay or nay, should we use these or not. And a lot of home people don't exactly know how to configure those firewalls correctly, but I don't know. It's a start. Now, this is very interesting. This actually showed up on the news, CNN, Fox, BBC, all over the place. And it's a new vaccine that says it stops HIV. Now, in reading this, it didn't say it actually completely stops it, but it does stop it to a dramatic amount, a large amount. The vaccine, made from a patient's own dendritic cells and HIV isolated from the patient's own blood, dendritic cells are crucial to the immune response. They grab foreign bodies in the blood and present them to other immune cells to trigger powerful immune system responses to destroy the foreign invaders. HIV infection normally turns these important immune system responses off, but animal studies have shown that when dendritic cells are loaded with whole killed AIDS viruses, they can trigger effective immune responses that keep infected animals from dying of AIDS.
Wow.
After getting 3 under-the-skin injections of a tailor-made vaccine, because it has to do with the HIV that's that they have, and person's own dendritic cells, the amount of HIV in the patient's blood cell, called the viral load, dropped by 80%.
Wow.
After a year, 8 of 18 patients had a 90% drop in HIV levels, and all patients' T cells stopped dropping. So that's an amazing discovery.
Well, that's when it goes back. It goes from AIDS to HIV.
Yeah, because in here it says stops HIV, and then it mentions here that it stopped animals from being killed by AIDS with AIDS virus.
Yeah, because you can have HIV. It's when you're going to die very soon from it. That's when it becomes AIDS.
Yeah. So, yeah, I believe that this happens, you know, even when in, like, a later stage or whatever. It, you know, your body's definitely going to be harmed from the lack of T cells and unhealthiness, but it's definitely something towards the right direction.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. Well, they did do a while back a study that actually they had a preventative vaccine or inoculation for it that actually decreased the amount of transmission or the acquisition of HIV.
Yeah. The researchers warned that their study is only proof of principle. It's not clear whether the patients do best with the vaccine, although there's evidence that vaccination should be given as articles not printed there, as after HIV infection is possible.
Maybe as soon as possible.
Okay, yeah, as soon as after. Only clinical trials comparing people who get the vaccine who do not show whether this vaccine really is an effective AIDS therapy. So, it's not saying it may not be the cure-all, but it definitely has been brought up because it does quite a bit compared to what's out there now. And is a very large step closer to helping people out with that,
yeah, and
that disease.
Well, like with most of the drug treatments, is there's a lot of already, you know, drug or cocktail resistant strains that are out there. So here, this tailor-made vaccine, you know, can come in there, and what do you know? You have a whole new therapy that it won't become resistant to.
Yeah.
You might have to redo the therapy, but it won't become resistant to it. Which is just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's like it's kind of surprising. You'd think that they may have figured that out before.
Actually, they very much did. It's probably just the process that made it a little bit more financially feasible.
Yeah, they're like, right now, yeah, we should probably come out with this. Because, something like that, I don't know, it may sound simple when you explain it, but it may be a lot more complex.
It would be. It's probably extremely expensive to do it even now.
Yeah.
Because think about it. If you have to create essentially a vaccine for a completely new, well, not a completely new, but a different virus every time. So there's no, like, mass production of it. It is engineered. But it could be done within a certain, you know, essentially a range where it could almost become manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
The process could be sped up quite a bit, especially with, you know, like how we're coming, our understanding of the genome is becoming better. That, I can see it.
Yeah, the genome, yeah, they're getting really big down to, getting information from the genome at incredible speeds.
Yeah, where they can manufacture most of the virus, you know, the vaccine, and then they just do little tweaks with a couple of genes at the end. And there you go. So it can incredibly speed up the process of doing that, and it's still being tailored.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good news. Speaking of things human related.
Yeah. So, are you really sexually active people? Start saving a couple $1 million for your Taylor vaccine.
Yeah, and then go out and do what you got to do.
That's right.
Well, there's other things to worry about other than that, but it's definitely a big one. The space station crew is forced to cut calories. This comes amidst the time that they're actually running really low on food, and their next shipment of cargo should be coming on the 23rd of December. Food is running so low aboard the International Space Station that flight controllers have instructed the two crewmen to cut back on calories, at least while a Russian supply ship arrives in a little over 2 weeks. If anything goes wrong with Christmas Day delivery, NASA will have no choice, given the grounding of its shuttle fleet, to abandon and station the station and bring the men back home early January. The cargo ship is very critical. There's no question about that, says Bill Gerstmeier, NASA's Science Station Program Manager. But he said that it is no more critical than previous supply runs, which have been conducted exclusively by the Russians ever since last year's Columbia disaster. He estimated that there is enough food to last even 14 days beyond Christmas Day, which there will be, after that, there will be nothing left. The American astronaut Leroy Chia and Russian cosmonaut Silazan Sharapov are sharing 2 months after their six-month stay aboard the space station. Last week, after pantry audit supplies running surprisingly low, they put on restricted diets in hopes of trimming 5% to 10% of their daily intake of 3,000 calories.
That's quite a bit of calories.
Yeah. What is it, like 2,200 or
2,500? No, all the FDA stuff is calculated to a 2,000-calorie diet. But our ancestors, like before the 1900s, you know, like a 1,500-calorie-a-day diet was, you were an aristocrat. You're living on a sugar, plantation. That's what, So they could deal with a whole lot less. It just become a little less, more functional.
All right. Being stuck in weightlessness and having to work up there all the time, and then I couldn't eat all I wanted to eat, that would, oof. So we'll see how good this mission does and see if they get their food on time. Otherwise, they're going to be jettisoned back here to the Earth. And, I think in the article, I think it says something like they're out 2 months of the total 6 months of the time that they need to be out there.
You know what's kind of interesting is it did say in there that, the Russian cargo ship has done all the deliveries since the Columbia disaster. What was kind of nifty, what this I really get from this article is it's being a little bit of a drama monger that they're like, oh, the Russians may not be able to do it, and our astronauts may be in trouble. Let's pressure NASA into accelerating it, and forcing them back into, sending shuttles back up.
Yeah.
That's really all it is. Because, the Russians will probably have their cargo ship will get there relatively on time. And well before they start to starve. So, sounds like they're trying to, create some news here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those astronauts are an investment. And you put them up there, and they want them working and getting the most out of your investment. And, there's definitely things like food and other things that we can take for granted down here. Well, in some places you can't take it for granted.
Yeah, that's right.
But, it's very essential to keeping that thing going. All right, now this I would say is very creative, very interesting, and because we talk about new technology stuff that comes out, maybe way out there, maybe like nanotechnology stuff like that. This is something that can come out here in the near future. Actually, it can come out today. It's already been developed, but it's an interesting system that does things in a...
Oh, all right. What is it?
Different way.
Tell me.
All right. Wanted to give the big opening. Basically, Wozniak Wheels of Zeus Tackles Enterprise Data Encryption. That's what it's called. Basically, Steve Wozniak has got data encryption based on location.
Ooh.
If you leave a certain location, you can't view the data.
I like it.
Steve Wozniak Wheels of Zeus is beginning to roll, and Enterprise Data Protection is one destination of the Apple Computer Inc. co-founder's mind. Wozniak offered a peek into his vision for the company on Zip Davis Media's Security Virtual Trade Show, where he introduced WAS location-based encryption, an application that uses GPS tracking within a wireless hub to encrypt and decrypt sensitive data for large businesses. Wheels of Zeus which launched in 2001 with backing from three big-name venture capital firms, has developed a wireless platform to power a range of location-based monitoring and notification services, and Wozniak believes data protection is a natural extension of the company's business. Hundreds of thousands of notebooks and laptops are stolen or lost every year, and when the when it happens, sensitive information or corporate data is gone out the door, said Wozniak. Basically, 98% of all stolen laptops are never recovered. With odds location-based encryption, Wozniak and companies can guard against the unauthorized removal of data outside of safe zones by using GPS tracking tied to the proprietary WozNet, which serves as local wireless network.
Sounds like he really wants to get his name to become a household name again.
Yeah, you know, and then they're going to come out with a chocolate factory pretty soon, and new Willy Wonka, and Woz, and...
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go start buying candy bars. The application involves the use of the dongle attached to a laptop, which communicates wirelessly with the base station controlled by an enterprise IT department. According to Wozniak's vision, the IT department sets specific transfer zones where the laptop device can be used, allowing an environment where the location of the laptop is known at all times and where the access can be denied entirely if a safe zone is breached. When the employee logs in, the device automatically requests valid zone information from the dongle. Once the preset zones are approved, the dongle regularly requests GPS positioning as a key to decrypt data on its own to allow access. And all the while, Wozniak said the internal base station is continually checking with the dongle for disconnection. Once everything clears approval, dongle decrypts the data based on the present zone data. This, Wozniak explained, should automatically block an employee or thief from picking up a laptop and moving out of the building with the IT department's approval. He said that the true value of the application kicks in when there is unauthorized removal of the device containing corporate secrets. Remember, the dongle is constantly requesting GPS positioning, so when there's a out-of-signal or out-of-zone reading, it triggers and automatically encrypts the data, and alerts are sent off to on-site security to reveal to relevant authorities. The dongle can be programmed to delete data or shut down sections of the device. Once the computer is removed from the physical zone, the keys are lost and unavailable, and the hard drive disk is gibberish. What if the dongle is removed? It automatically detects base station reporting immediately. Decryption of the data is done through the dongle, so no dongle means no use of critical data.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah.
Because you steal it, it becomes useless.
You need to do that with, like, OnStar or whatever. You know, try to steal your car and then...
It just shuts it down.
Shuts it down. Well, they have that, actually, with just normal car alarms, but... Shut it down. There's a GPS. Maybe it's another feature in there.
Yeah, that's how most things will become in the future.
All right, well, if you're like most drivers out there and you see a red light that nobody's coming the other way.
It means speed up.
Yeah, and that red light is there forever. And, you know, you want to pull through and you're looking around as the cop's around. And you might go through, you might not, but you wonder, why the hell is that red light there forever? When there's no cars coming. So basically, this is talking about traffic lights that respond to local conditions. Basically, it could help ease congestions and be a smarter traffic control service. Have you ever wished, as you sat at a red light, that you had the power to switch it to the green? A traffic researcher is proposing that giving motorists precisely this could improve the efficiency of city roads. The catch, there would have to be a catch, is that this control wouldn't be handed over to an individual driver. Instead, they would exercise in collectivity or collectively. If a large enough convoy of cars approach red light, this would force the light to turn green while the other lights in the junction remain red. Carlos Jurgensen of the Free University of Brussels, Belgium, outlines his theory in a preprint published on ARXIV. He says his system of traffic lights would be able to adapt to changing traffic conditions, allowing it to find a better switch sequence than other imposed rigidly on all situations. And I'll go through the article a little bit more here. There have been some attempts to make traffic signals more flexible. responding to the state of the traffic, these intelligent advanced traffic management systems generally connect the lights to a centralized computer that is constantly seeking an optimal switching sequence. Such approaches are costly to implement, however, and can be computationally very challenging. In Gershenson's method, by contrast, traffic lights are at a junction act on their own and responding simply to local conditions. So they just work on their own and they handle each area and whatnot. So in the end, if it's working effectively, then you on a single entity on its own, not concerned with any of the other lights, and the other lights are working on effectiveness, eventually it's going to evolve to where, even though they're independently running themselves, that they're all independently running themselves efficiently, and the whole traffic system could be more efficient. Now, I'm sure that actually would probably take a bit of study to make sure that really works, but it's definitely a possibility that...
Because like the traffic lights that we have here, they kind of work on a sensor basis and a timing basis and are hooked up to a central hub. So they do work very similar to that. It's just that they don't have the ability to...
adapt so rapidly.
Yeah, to be able to seek out, there's a bunch of oncoming cars this way, and there's none everywhere else. Yeah, then they can switch. But they do actually have, like, photo sensors and magnet sensors and all that sort of thing that do detect when cars are stopped.
Yeah. Yeah, they do that. And actually, I would say lights here in Arizona run pretty good. They're made so if you do the speed limit, maybe 5 over, if you hit a green, you should be able to hit all the other greens. There's no traffic.
Most of them are 46 miles an hour.
Yeah. And, works out pretty good. Now, if you find... I find that if I go the speed limit, I can hit all greens.
So but what's really strange is that there's the quarter-mile lights, which those really are what do a number on you. Because they're green. What they're like for the small side street, it's only green for maybe 15 seconds. The whole light that's green and yellow, and then it's green the other way. Well, then the other cycle is almost a minute 20. So it's kind of a that's those lights that you sit at forever.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, this is going to be our last story here of the evening. This is basically a new company that's come out to do quite a few things for the open source community. It's an open source group, and they've just officially launched themselves on it was early December. I don't know the date on this one. A coalition of service providers claims it will shake up the open source market by offering an alternative to the larger vendors. It aims to counter the claims made by Microsoft that open source is the more expensive option. The group is called the Open Source Consortium, and it's a group of more than 60 companies that have been established to offer what it claims as unbiased, proprietary, vendor-free voice for all organizations contemplating an open source rollout. The consortium created following... demanding for areas such as the public sector, hopes to bring impartial clarity to the debate. OCS executive Mark Taylor said that the consortium would give smaller businesses a chance to compete with the likes of IBM and Sun for open source concepts. It's all about the smaller players. We want to open up the markets that they have to that they don't have access to. And again, Taylor said that the OSC would offer four services: strategic consulting, deployment consulting, training, and support. The consortium already has close links with their public sector organization, DOCSITM, he claimed. The group will look at several technical areas, for example, as the use of Apache and making websites browsable for open source browsers. While the consortium is being officially launched today, the group has been working quietly in the background for some time. Taylor said the OSC was trailblazing for open source use was being monitored by open source groups in other countries. We know that France and Germany are both looking at what we're doing, although It will be UK and one only at first, and we hope to take the concept elsewhere. We're well ahead of other countries. There's not even the equivalent of the OSC in the US, he said. So, I guess they're going to be the overseers of the open source opinionated world of open source. I don't know.
Yeah, isn't that kind of fun that they don't have to be elected? They just kind of are, they don't even create it. They just self-proclaim themselves that.
Yeah, so hopefully, you know, you got to kind of watch to see what they're going to say as what is yes or no and all that. And obviously there's 60 companies there. There might be one or two or five or 10 companies that might have a different opinion about something.
Yeah, and they're going to fraction off and they're going to become their own little, you know, like cult or, you know, insurgents.
Yeah.
That was my favorite word.
Insurgents.
I was listening to the news and
everyone's an insurgent.
Yeah, I was really, really thinking about that.
Rob a Circle K, you're an insurgent.
Yeah, it's like they're not terrorists, they're not rebels, they're insurgents.
They're insurgents. Yeah, everyone's an insurgent. Somebody, you know, does a drunk driving down the road, they're insurging on my society, Dan.
Yeah.
Insurging all over.
Wow, what a terrible term. And what a terrible act.
Yeah, it's a terrifying act by an insurgent.
Yeah.
So... but yeah, so we'll see how that company works out and how things go. You know, it's like an alliance I think that Red Hat had formed before with a few other people, and they're trying to do an open standard and stuff like that. And you know, there does need to be a collaborating kind of board of things on some open source stuff to bring things together and have things work better together and build into build the pyramid up. You know.
Yeah, but if it. You know, well, the beauty of open source is that it actually works on a chaos principle. So whatever.
It's like the traffic light monitoring itself.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And once you start imposing other functions onto that, other structures and architectures, you know, the beauty of it starts to, you know, turn a little ugly.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, you know, it's this open source thing is, you know, can be twisted. If, like, let's say if a large spokesman for open source says something that isn't really with the true inherent roots of the open source, and then people start believing it, and then that way, you know, it's like you're this open source group versus this open source group.
Well, just when you apply any limitations to it, you start to change it and limit it and pervert it.
Yeah, and it sounds much like, you know, people are doing open source, but it's not truly open source, like what Sun's doing with their licensing. They want to do open source, but it's not really, you know, Richard Stallman's idea of what open source is, and it's, you know, but I guess it's, you know.
Well, it kind of has to be, but at the same time, it doesn't have to be. Because, yes, let the actual physical hardware be its limitations.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for the end of our show. Unless you have anything to add, VR?
No, I'm done.
All right. Well, I, yeah, check out the forums. Shoot us some email. Oh, yeah, an update on the Kevin Mitnick interview. We almost got that pulled off, but we didn't.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, I got told at the last moment that something had happened. I really don't even know all the details because the interview was really out of my hands. It was a group, it was one other person that... had connections to Kevin and wanted to do an interview and got the go-ahead to do it, and then something happened. So, I don't know. We'll work on that, or we'll see what we can do in the future. But that's the update on that interview. Unfortunately, we didn't get that recorded because we were going to put that in the show.
But, you know, all you loyal listeners, don't hold your breath.
Yeah, don't hold your breath. All right. Well, this is Slip Mode signing out.
VR. Later.
All right. We'll see everyone in 2 weeks. See you then. Come on.